You're with Pocket Docs. I'm Claudia Taranto. The art of letter writing is rapidly dying. But what have we lost in the race towards speed and ease of communication? I find letters are often more thoughtful and poetic than an email or text message that's dashed off in haste. And thoughtful and poetic are two words I'd use to describe this letter Gary Abrams wrote in Melbourne to a childhood friend in South Africa. It's a letter he could never deliver.
Dear Antoinette, you knew me when we were both very young. We would have been no more than 9 or 10 years old when we last saw each other. Your mother was our family's maid, from when I was 2 years old until the time I teetered on the edge of puberty. She cooked for us, cleaned up after us, babysat us, did the laundry, the cleaning, the ironing, made the beds each day, prepared school lunches. She did everything. But I don't remember her, and I hope that doesn't offend. I vaguely remember her pale blue cotton maid's uniform, complete with apron and headscarf. I vaguely recall her dark brown skin, her short wiry hair. And if I try really hard, I can almost see the faint trace of her face, unfocused, hovering just out of reach of my mind's eye. I know she began with us when we lived in a tiny two-bedroom flat somewhere in Johannesburg. I don't remember your mother, but I remember this flat. Just writing this brings to mind odd details, sharp, clear, and unquestioned. I recall that the walls were textured and rough, that particular plastered finish so popular in the late 70s, that to my little child's mind looked like thick icing on a cake. I remember a giant cork dining table. I remember brown carpets. I remember a pool outside, but I don't remember your mother. I know that when my family moved to a bigger house in the newly formed suburbs on the outskirts of Johannesburg, she came with us. I remember that this new house, which became my family home up until the day I left 17 years later, had a maid's quarters attached to it, a little annex off the back courtyard behind the kitchen, which contained a small bedroom, a functional bathroom, and if my memory serves me right, a small storage room where the garden rake, shovels, and lawnmower was kept. How's that for symbolism? I remember this area being sort of off-limits, a slightly lowly place I wasn't allowed. It wasn't carpeted. The bare concrete floors painted a dark maroon like ox's blood. The room contained a small steel-framed single bed, its legs placed on short stacks of bricks to elevate it unnaturally high. I learned this was to protect the sleeper from the African mythological little demon named the Tokolosh, who would tickle your feet as you slept and curse you. I distinctly remember not feeling too bothered about it, as it was clearly something that only affected black people, and I was safe in my carpeted bedroom and soft bed in the main house. But the story, and the bed on the bricks, added to the mystery and allure of these maids' quarters, and I was forever trying to sneak glimpses into that room, this place that was so other, attached to the back of my safe and white family home. I'm sure you remember this room in much more detail than I do. It was the room, after all, in which you would stay when you visited your mother during the school holidays. I don't know where you lived the rest of the time. Perhaps I was told at some point. More than likely, I never asked. All I knew was that around 3 times a year, you'd arrive and bunk with your mother. I don't remember the first time you stayed. But there in the folders of my childhood memories are snippets of you. You were my age, and I know that for several years, there you'd be and we would play. And in the evening, after dinner was served and cleared, and the washing up completed, the back door from the kitchen would be shut, and you and your mother would retire into the night, behind the house, off the backyard, into that strange little annex that was your mother's home. Looking back, I now wonder where your other home was. In what township did you live? Did you live in one of those small towns and villages existing on large blocks of land referred to as homelands? Semi-countries parceled off by past governments and given over to the indigenous people of Southern Africa. Homelands with exotic yet inferior sounding names like Transkei or Siskei, Baputetswana or Lebowo. lands that my family could pass through untroubled, ignoring the makeshift borders as they weren't of consequence to us. I remember these small villages well, if immaturely, like pictures in a child's storybook. The fascinating huts made of earth and mud, painted decoratively in bright colours and patterns, set amongst rolling green hills or on flat, barren and dusty landscapes. Or was your home in one of those large, corrugated iron townships, masses of land cramped full of makeshift dwellings made up of iron, cardboard and prefabricated sheets? Places where row upon row of rough shacks dominate the eyeline, suffocated in a thick layer of dust and smog. And townships whose inhabitants jostled and fought for space. I grew to detest these vile and filthy townships, dotted as they were around the country, tainting the beautiful, fertile land with their grey, poverty-stricken meanness. Did you grow up in a place like that? Who took care of you while your mother took care of my family and I? Who made sure you went to school or packed your bags each time you would come and stay with us? How did you get from there to us? Did you have to travel far? I'm ashamed as I write this that I'll never know the answers, and that I never learned to care enough to ask until much later. I wonder now what you thought as you arrived in the affluent suburbs, the large houses safely obscured behind high walls, the large front lawns and back gardens acting as green grassy moats surrounding these little castles. Did you envy your mother getting to live amongst us? Did you grow to resent it? Or just accept it in that unchallenged way children have of taking life at face value? Antoinette, there are a few memories I want to share with you. At first, we were just children of the same age, and as children do, we played. We spent most days in the garden, thick grass blanketing our feet as we ran and tumbled, chased and fled. Hot days were made cool by playing with the garden hose. We placed cubes of ice in our mouths and ran around in circles as the ice burned our tongues and numbed our cheeks. We ate avocados laced with lemon juice and sprinkled with fine white sugar, a way I haven't eaten an avocado in nearly 30 years. I remember your favourite snack, whole chilled tomatoes eaten like apples, after each bite sprinkling salt on the wound, making our lips dry and puckered. These are fond memories, and when I think of my childhood, now somewhat idealised as the harsher truths of adulthood have robbed the world of its idyllic glow, I often think of you, my playmate and friend. But of my memories of you, these are not the most immediate. Once, when playing, we got into a fight. I don't remember over what, though my guess would be ownership of some toy. Of course, all the toys we played with were mine. I had many and no doubt you had none. Regardless, we got into an argument. And the argument grew into a fight. And the fight became violent, pinching and scratching, and ultimately me biting your arm. I bit so hard that I drew blood. Actual teeth marks perfectly imprinted on your little girl's arm, each mark slowly seeping blood. I remember this so clearly because what happened next still chills me. My grandmother came running out to us. She saw the bite marks and blood on your arm, and she picked me up and carried me inside. Not to scold me, not to punish me, and not to protect you. Do you understand? Her concern was not for you, the one who had been bitten, but for me, for having gotten your blood in my mouth. She washed my mouth out with actual soap and made me rinse several times, making sure not even the smallest trace of your blood was left. Your blood. Your black and unclean blood. I learned that day that your blood was dangerous, that it was different from mine, and that it was something to be feared. Something else. Being of my age and being my friend, you would sit with my family and I at the dinner table while your mother served the dinner. such a layered image, the maid's daughter dining with the masters while the maid serves. I imagine this went on for years, none of us thinking anything of it. Only later, my father decided it was no longer appropriate for you to join us. My parents had a fight about it, my father trying to lay down the law and my mother ridiculing him. He denies it now, but in any event he must have won, because you were no longer allowed at the dinner table. It was probably a few years later that your mother left us, and by proxy, you left us too. I don't remember why or when, but I know another maid took your mother's place and moved into that small little room off the back courtyard. But there is something else. Something strange and unsettling. Something that's haunted me for many years and causes me to write to you. The details are vague, though the feelings are sharp. One day, I must have been 14 or 15 years old, the phone rang. This was back in the days where phone conversations were still had in family hallways, the earpiece nuzzled between chin and shoulder, fingers twirling and trailing the twisted phone cord. A girl introduced herself, said hello, and asked to speak to me. I was puzzled. I didn't know the voice, and I didn't recognize the strange-sounding name. She proceeded to ask after me, ask how I was, ask about school, and ask about my plans for the future, about my friends and my life. The girl's voice was accented. Her English had that particular African lilt. She told me a little about herself, her schooling, and her hopes for final exams. I spent the whole conversation confused and defensive, annoyed to be bothered by this stranger. I was very dismissive and rude. It was only several minutes after hanging up that it dawned on me that this girl was you. At first I was irritated and suspicious. Why had you called? What did you want? What the hell did you expect me to do for you? Only later, years later, when for some reason this phone call kept returning to my thoughts, did I reconsider that you were just calling to say hello, to check in with an old friend, to make contact with a childhood playmate. And I think about what it must have taken for you to locate my number, to find a phone, to make that call out of the blue so many years after last seeing me, only to be dismissed so coldly. I had no way of finding you then, and I have no way of finding you now. Despite your mother caring for me for the duration of my childhood, I never learned your family name. I never learned about where you returned to after each visit. I can only wonder what became of your life amidst the chaos and change that followed in the turbulent decade of the 90s. Were you, like me, in a classroom when the news was announced that there would be a referendum and a vote towards abolishing those astonishing and racist laws? Were you, like me, gathered in a school library to watch the live footage of Mandela being released on that bright, sun-filled day in 1994? Did you get to finish high school? Were you able to go to university, perhaps the first member of your family to get the chance to do so? Did you move to the city and begin a career and live the dream so many people fought and died for? Did you get to be a part of that new South Africa promised to so many? Or, like most, did life not change for you? Did you remain in some obscure rural village, far from the big cities and slow trickling wealth? Did you leave school early and help your family eke out an existence with odd jobs and labor sold cheaply? Did you do what I hate to think of most, but what is most likely, and find work as a domestic for a middle-class family who would never ask your surname? Did you find your own little annex off the back of a big house with a small bedroom and oxblood floors? Do you find yourself cooking for and cleaning up after another family's children, while your own child lives far away in some unnamed village, perhaps with your mother? I hope not. I hope life has surprised you, and perhaps, like me, you've had the opportunity to go after your dreams. I hope, like me, you look back on those decades that are slipping further away with each passing year, surprised that you ever lived in a place with such backward and cruel laws. I hope that you also remember, at odd moments, a little playfellow with whom you enjoyed many summers, young enough to be ignorant of the strange circumstances of your life. And I hope that, if you remember that phone call, the memory doesn't cause you as much pain as it does me. Antoinette. If she's still alive, I want you to tell your mother this. Tell her I live in Australia now. Tell her I don't have any children. Tell her I live alone, and that I cook for myself, and make my own bed, and do my own laundry. Tell her, every Saturday I vacuum the floors, and mop the kitchen, and clean my toilet and bathtub. Tell her that I serve my own food and scrub the pots and pans clean myself. Tell her that I'm not rich. That over the years I have taken many odd jobs to help pay my way through the world. Tell her there was even a time when I was hired by a wealthy family to help clean their home and serve their dinner on a Friday night. Tell her I'm sorry I don't remember her more fully, but that I remember you. I remember you. With love and sorrow and hope, your friend, Gary.
Theatre director and writer Gary Abrams with Dear Antoinette. Gary's letter was written for the 2016 Melbourne Jewish Writers Festival gala opening night. It was produced by Jay Kranz, and the sound engineer was Marty Peralta.